The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. It's good to see you all today. And I'm going to try to draw out some jewels from Reverend Master Jiyu's Dharma treasury today, as I have experienced them in my own training. And it's very humbling to have this opportunity to do so, to talk about her teaching. As in preparing for this talk, I realized how incredibly vast her Dharma treasury was, and I feel like I'm just touching on a little part of it. And yet, within each jewel is contained the whole of the Dharma too, but I can't possibly offer all of that today. But perhaps it will give you a bit of a taste and give you some of the help that I received, which was very great, from her teaching. In addition, I can't really separate my own training from her teaching. That's many of us monks this week who have been preparing talks have found it a little difficult because it's so integrated with our own training. And in fact, also into the teaching that comes from our own hearts. So it really is one and the same. And yet, each of us gives unique expression to it also. So it's a very interesting study in the, you know, the all is one and the all is different in that perspective within the transmission of the Dharma. So please understand in offering this that, you know, any genuine teacher points the way for a disciple and to a monastic community, to its congregation and lay trainees. And of course, it's for us to put it into practice. So I'm well aware that there are many jewels that were offered to me that I haven't yet found and I'm not yet putting into practice. But certainly, there have been many. And as I was reflecting on this, I had this sense of a kind of garland of jewels of Dharma, if you like, a sort of rosary almost of Dharma treasures. And something that themes of teaching that have gone through my life, my training, and that perhaps I kind of revolve, as it were, as I continue training, that come to me in new ways, sometimes in the same old way. That can be discouraging when it's the same old, but in fact, it's usually a little different the next time around. So there's this sense of this garland of Dharma treasures, Dharma jewels that I am benefiting from and using in my training. And so we have to walk the path ourselves, and the expression of what comes from each of us, however, will be somewhat different, as I said, and we'll also have not only the flavor of Reverend Master Jiyu's teaching, Koho Zenji, but also our particular Buddhist lineage, the Soto Zen tradition, as it's developing in the West. So we have this sense of Buddhism, and yet also something new and different and fresh, which is really wonderful. And so it should always be. Reverend Master was really big on keeping the Dharma alive, making it a living presence in our lives. So I'd like to show a little bit of that if I can. When I first encountered Reverend Master Jiyu Kennett, Roshi at the time we called her, through her book, Selling Water by the River, which many of you may also have seen years ago. That was the early edition of Zen's Eternal Life. And I was living in England, in London. I was working there after finishing school and traveling. And I was at a point in my life where I was very much searching for really a way to stop creating suffering. for myself and others. I wasn't a heroin addict or anything like that, but I was very aware that I had made mistakes in my life and that I was on a certain, going in a certain direction that would create possibly more suffering. So I was searching some psychological means and others. And when I began to find Eastern religions, Hinduism as well as Buddhism, I began to feel like I was hitting something that would work. I, of course, had been raised as a Roman Catholic and had received much help from, of course, the Christian religion also, but I got to a point in my youth where it just didn't make sense to me. I didn't have a good teacher, I suppose, and I had questions that just didn't seem to get answered, so I drifted away from that. And I was looking for things that were more very practical and fundamental, something I could do. And when I found Buddhism, and indeed was handed Reverend Master's book by a friend at another Buddhist center in London, I began to look at that and began to learn to meditate from the book. I had done a little bit of Theravada meditation, loving kindness meditation, but what Reverend Master Jiu was describing in Selling Water by the River struck a very deep chord in me. And I was struck by the clarity of her teaching. So I wanted to just talk a bit about that. For me, how she had the ability to bring the teaching alive and make it accessible. It wasn't this, you know, this mysterious Zen thing that, you know, yeah, it sounded pretty, but you had no idea what they were talking about. Certainly, I must say, in Selling Water by the River, I couldn't understand most of the text in terms of the translations of Dogen and Kazan and so on. Of course, I realized there was great depth to that, but her chapters, her teaching seemed to me to be very clear. Also, there were many books on Buddhism and I would start them and I just couldn't get beyond them. They just seemed a bit dry and methodical, and somehow she brought it alive for me. And I was able to begin meditating from reading her description on how to do it. And the clarity of that has always been a great help to me. When I read something of hers or when I heard a Dharma talk of hers, it would just go right to the source and be immediately healing and bring peace. And even if it was hard to bear, it would immediately be of help. I'm going to give you a little example of that. You've all read this, perhaps, In Zen is Eternal Life. But I'll just read you the very first thing that she writes in the book. All men know suffering, which is as the mud in which the lotus takes its root. All men, or people, know the lotus blossom, which gazes at the heavens. Few, indeed, know how to nourish the root of true religion within themselves, in the mud of ignorance that surrounds them. And fewer still know how to make that root flourish and grow the long stem needed in the dark water before the flower can bloom. In the clear light of day. I knew this was going to be hard. In this, and then she talks about the introduction. This is her introduction to the book. And in her introduction, she's going to attempt to show how to grow the long stem of the lotus from the root to the blossom. For the stem of the lotus and Zen training are identical. So there you have it. And this particular teaching has been helpful to me throughout my entire training, particularly in times of difficulty, but all sorts of times. But it's like many teachings, and also it's the reason why we recite the same scriptures every day. In times of need, they come to us. And when you have a teacher, something of what they've given you comes to you when you need it. Of course, you have to be willing to hear it and to listen. But many a time, this has come to me because we so often have this idea that the training is some special thing other than happening, you know, that which is happening right at the present time. When something difficult happens, there's a big mess, it's messy, we we feel like somehow we've blown it and or someone else has blown it, things aren't going as they should be. And on a subtle level, we equate successful training with all the external situation sort of working up the way we imagined it, or, you know, according to our expectation. And I myself have found more and more subtle levels of these expectations. And it's helpful to see them. You know, it's a little disconcerting when you realize just how much of that you have. And yet, it's so helpful. And this teaching has been a reminder to me many, many times that actually this lotus blossom that we're growing in our training grows out of the mud of ignorance. It grows in the mud, you know. It doesn't grow in some pretty place in space. It doesn't, you know, and it's really remarkable how we have this idea that it grows in some other beautiful place and all that mucky stuff can just kind of be back there somewhere. But rather, it's right out of the mud of ignorance, the mud of discomfort, the mud of our mistakes, the messes in the world, if you want to put it that way. No reason why we can't grow a lotus blossom in this very world of suffering as it is. Yeah, we don't have to go to some other place. So many a time this has come to me, and even more recently when we lost our last abbot, when it was very difficult, and I'm thinking, how could this happen? You know, this isn't supposed to happen. And suddenly it came to me again. Oh, yes, yeah. There's the mud again, another level, another perhaps unfolding of the lotus occurring. And when you have that perspective, the training becomes very, very different. Reverend Master Jisho spoke yesterday of changing your perception. And these teachings can help with that. Even just a tiny shift puts you into quite a different perspective. So there's an example of something that just speaks directly to the heart, but it's also so clear. It gives you a sense of how this is supposed to work, this training business. Well, when I first came here, after many twists and turns, in September 1973, I came for a month of training as a layperson. And in fact, Reverend Master Ji wasn't here. But the community was working here. I think at that time, Reverend Master Haryo was the head novice, the chief junior. And we got all our work assignments from him. And I have to say, I was very impressed with how kind he was and how very still he was. And it was through Reverend Master Ji's disciples that I was attracted to her teaching, which is an interesting thing. And within a week or so, I had a very strong attraction to training with the community, following her teaching, and perhaps becoming a monk eventually. And that was without having met her. So when I reflect on that time, I realize that I met her through her disciples and through her Dharma. And it was the Dharma that really attracted me at first. And each of us comes, as now referring to monks in particular, but anyone who knew her, we come to the training perhaps from a slightly different angle. Some really connected with her as a personality, others more through her teaching, others through the monastic life itself or the community life, any of these things. And eventually, though, we seem to go through all of it. So, of course, in the long run, I came to love her deeply as a person, but I also realized that she was a human being, and I was expressing it through her humanity, but she wasn't, she wasn't putting herself forth as a god and as this being the only expression of the Dharma. Nonetheless, I hadn't met her, and yet I had this sense of a great magnanimous spirit in the community, which I later realized was her presence, in a way. Yeah. She was very much present, even though at the time she was in England, starting Throssell at that time. It was the second time she went over starting that community. She came back just before I left that month. By the end of my month stay, I was hoping to be able to stay at the Abbey, because at that time I was free in my life and I was considering either going to university and studying music and psychology, and or doing something else. And when I came here, I realized it was the something else that I wanted. And but I was from Canada, and at that time, the Abbey had just been applying for a student visa capability, you know, with the government. They were applying to be able to give student visas to people from other countries so they could train here. And during that time, the Abbey was being inspected by, you know, government, officials from the Superintendent of Education Department and so on and so forth. And so it was not a good time for them to have foreign, you know, people from another country here, because they could have been in trouble for keeping me here too long. So that was one of my first big disappointments, but also big teachings, was I wasn't allowed to just stay. And so I had to go back to Canada, and it was Reverend Master's, you know, I heard that it was Reverend Master's decision, and they gave me the reason, but I accepted it and went and, you know, did my training on my own up in Canada, and then eventually applied to come back. And was able to come back in 1975 and was ordained by her. But in the meantime, I got married. At that time, we had married priests here. And so I got married to another a priest who was here. And nonetheless, that's another whole story. But I came back here on my own. There was some discussion of whether I wanted to be ordained by this other priest, and I never had the intention, but I did marry him. And that was different. It's different. Different relationship. And in any case, bless his heart, but I wanted to come and be ordained with her, and I'm very glad I did, was clear on that. And I came back on my own, and my spouse stayed in Vancouver and ran the priory up there, the first Vancouver priory. So I was here for almost a year on my own, and I realized that was the reason I really came to Shasta Abbey. And then eventually he came down, and for a period of time we had a property near here, Canondale, where married couples who were training at the Abbey came, lived, you know, and so on. And anyway, long story short, you know, eventually we made a vow of celibacy and gradually separated and continued our training separately. But we were officially married for 12 years. And the Abbey went through a period of gradually changing its practice from the Japanese system of having married priests to the traditional Buddhist system of monks being celibate. And I had a sense soon, you know, even near the beginning, that that was the way it was going to go. Although it wasn't easy, an easy process. It was a good idea in the long run. And yet, it was a lot of valuable training experience there. But all of that had immense teaching for me as well. Before I became a monk, I was here for a retreat in 1974. And Reverend Master, I met Reverend Kim Seng then, fortunately, her ordination master, and I was, Reverend Master Jiu came, and at that time her health was a little better, and she would come and give us talks, and we were meditating in a little room up in what's now our Dharma house, was the lay trainees meditation hall, and she would come in and give us these talks while we were meditating. And I remember the very first one that I heard, which was on dis-ease of the heart. And it really stuck with me. And it was very inspiring and powerful teaching. And it made it very clear to me that I did want to be her disciple. The teaching was just, it's sort of like you have these images of a kanzai on, sometimes, you know, with a hook pulling beings out of sea of suffering, you know, it was like that, just whoosh, you know. Now, of course, one has to be open to that as well, but it's amazing how the Dharma works, and if you're just sitting still enough to hear even a little bit of it, how it can pull you out of, well, potential lifetimes of misery. And that was, I didn't know it fully at the time, but upon reflection, I realized that was what was happening. She talked about the First Noble Truth. truth, excuse me, in very sort of ordinary English, and how to, you know, the importance of sitting still with the dis-ease and not acting on it, and how to find true ease within that. So some other little bits of her teaching. When I was first a monk here, new monk, again in 1975, her health was a little better still. It was still okay, which later she became quite ill, although she did have diabetes and other problems. And she was amazingly energetic and would give talks quite often. And we had a series of talks. I was a novice monk, of course, and junior monk, we called them in those days. And we had talks on many things. I looked up my old junior class notes, and we have talks on the manual of Buddhism, you know, basic Buddhist doctrines, ceremonial. She transmitted the entire Soto Zen ceremonial as she was taught in Sojiji to us. You know, we have remarkable amount of detail, absolutely phenomenal amount of detail in that, and all the teaching that goes with that. And so I see here we had talks on, you know, how to use all the different instruments, the inkin, the kaishaku, the wooden clappers, the wooden fish, the gongs, the drum. And in those days, we were doing an achalanatha ceremony every day. And it happened, the Achalanatha Shrine is in what's now the Achalanatha House. That's why it's called Achalanatha House, because there used to be a shrine in there. And we would go in there every day. And she had, and you know who Achalanatha Bodhisattva is, all of you, right? Depicted here in the corner, this fierce, you know, Bodhisattva representing the grasping of the will, sitting still in the midst of conditions, determination. And so there were images of Achalanatha. We did it in Japanese at that time. So there was a drum beat to it. And on one side was the drum, and on the other side was, she had this light with this colored disc in front of it. And there were all the colors of the Buddha's halo on this disc, made of translucent plastic. And it rotated with this light behind it. So it was this drum going, and this light of all these colors flashing, you know, and it was like, it was wild. And but yet it was, you know, it was very traditional, and it was intended to get you to sit still, you know, in the midst of all conditions. You know, it was very, you could be totally distracted, or you could be very moved to sit still. It was very strong, and we all learned how to do this ceremony, to beat the drum. We all had, we were chaplains as novice monks for senior monks doing it each day, and we also were actually doing kanzen ceremonies every day in that manner. So that was quite a treat. I loved that ceremony, and I sort of almost regretted losing that color, those colored lights, but maybe one day we'll resurrect that. Of course, she taught us an awful lot about music, religious music, plain song chant, and why she put our scriptures to this music and so on. And in terms of ceremonial, we had classes from time to time in which she really brought to life the reason why we do it and the great value of it, and walked us through every step of a ceremony, such as morning service, in great detail, pointing out the purpose of each movement and how, you know, just in summary, it was a great practice in helping us to work together in harmony, to be mindful, obviously, to do a moving meditation. I often think of it as realizing the, you know, great Master Dogen's teaching on how the body is deeply significant. We train with our bodies as well as our mind. So it's not just it can become a mental exercise if you're not careful. But when you have to start doing moving meditation in this way, it takes on another dimension. And it taught us how to discipline our bodies in a kind way, how to work together. So we had a tremendous amount of help with that. And whereas at first I was slightly put off by ceremonial and you know, ceremonies and chanting and so on, as soon as I learned to meditate during it, when I realized it was another form of meditation, it completely changed for me. And then, of course, with her instructions, it came alive. I'm still discovering many dimensions to our ceremonies as a result of her inspiration in that regard. I remember a very significant thing along those lines. We chanted the Sandokaya and the Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi every morning, and I just remember at one point when I experienced that shift and learned to meditate during the chanting, how the meaning of that started to come into my body and mind, and how incredibly inspiring those two scriptures were for me, and how I felt a really deep connection with this particular tradition through them. Other series of talks she gave us were on the Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey, which is a wonderful little book written by Koun Ejo, one of Great Master Dogen's chief disciples, you know, transcriptions of some of his talks to his monks, very pithy little talks to his monks. And I'll just read you a few of the notes to give you a flavor of it. You know, Reverend Master wasn't afraid to look at Dogen as a real life person and look at his, even his shortcomings, as well as his appreciating his incredible Dharma and vast teaching. But in one of them, she comments, there was a danger of becoming caught in externals. Dogen was very, very concerned about external criticism from the Chinese trainees, and so did not accept Nyojo Zenji's offer. His master, his Chinese master at Tendozan, offered him the position of being his chaplain, his personal assistant, which is a very honored position, but he was a foreigner, and he felt, you know, and of course there was some prejudice, you know, against him to some extent, and he so he declined the offer. But it's interesting that Reverend Master, you know, saw that aspect of it. You know, he could have accepted the offer too. You know, we think of these people and what they did as kind of absolutes, but you know, they were human beings and they made their choices. And of course, there's valuable teaching in all the good that they do in all their dharma, but there's teaching also in perhaps some of the at least potential mistakes they made. And she wasn't afraid to look at that both with our ancestors and with herself, and encouraging us not to copy the mistakes. You know, look at what perhaps one might have, you know, done as well. Dogen apparently, she says, was not willing to stick his neck out. He was still too caught up in nationalism. Interesting. And Nyojo Zenji never offered him the position again. Of course, all was well between Dogen and his master. There was no problem here, so don't misunderstand this. But it's an interesting observation, because I myself later had a similar experience where during a time when later in my training, when my marriage was breaking up and some of the monks here were leaving, and there was a lot of criticism of Reverend Master, which happens sometimes with masters. And I was going through a bit of a hard time there, and Reverend Master Jiu offered me a position of being the treasurer here. I'd been the assistant treasurer for a few years. I turned it down, you know. Other times she offered me the opportunity to go with her to Berkeley, and I had something else in mind, you know. And I didn't do this all the time, but there were significant times when I, out of my complete cluelessness and foolishness, said no thanks, you know. And later, of course, upon reflection, I realized, whoa, what, these were just amazing opportunities that I could have trained closely with her. I did train closely with her in other situations. And so just to see the humanity in even Dogen's training, you know, and her training. Anyway, I'm learning. another chapter, she comments, we have to give first on giving before anything comes to us. Don't get stuck in holiness. These are my notes. So, I thought that was a good one. You know, getting stuck in holiness, no. You know, it has to come to me first. You know that one? I'm just going to drop a few of these little... Okay, then there's another one. Do not work for money so that you can pile up security. And these are my somewhat inadequate notes from her speaking. So that you can pile up security and guard against more than the now. Do not use it for fame and gain. We need to know what the difference between need and want is. Nothing must be abused. All that is offered must be accepted and used. But do not indulge yourself and get caught up in your greeds for food, clothing, affection, etc. Or even too much talking. Do not give advice unless asked for and needed. Do not try to put all of this into practice at once. I found that very reassuring. Take one section of yourself that needs working on and start with that. Don't waste time deciding what to work on or how to do it. All of this was very reassuring to me because that was me. Oh my God, this is so huge. Where do I start? This actually shows unwillingness if one is too worried. I'm so awful. Where do I start? And not. It can be a subtle form of unwillingness to do something about oneself. Just deal with things as they arise. Start with whatever comes first. And I have to say, I wrote this as a very junior monk based on her talks in 1975, and I reread them once in a while because they're very, very applicable still. So one last one on the Zui Monkey there, chapter 5. Learn from your senses and don't allow them to deceive you. Don't hear or see in the way of your old attachments. Don't be stuck. Now remember, Dogen's exhorting his monks here, but this is Ramesh Jiu's interpretation. Don't be stuck with your old opinions and emotions. Just sit as a Buddha and you will become a Buddha. Do not worry about not being what you think you should be. Just do the best you can. One who has eyes does not necessarily see, and one who has ears may not hear. Sometimes what you see is really there, and sometimes what you see is not there. Again, words to live by. And it's true. And this, again, I must say, later in my life, I did go away from the Abbey for a while to pay off some debts, and I started my own tutoring service in order to make some money and pay off some debts, and recovering from a difficult period. And I was in touch with Reverend Master Jiu, but teachings like this, I didn't realize how much they sort of trickled through into my life and into the deep recesses of my being and came, to the surface in times of need, because that was a very big teaching for me when I was going through my difficulties then, in later years, how much credence I gave to my thoughts and my feelings and my emotions. It was remarkable. I lived by myself for a while, a number of years, so I had opportunity to be quiet quite a bit, and it began to dawn on me that I could, through meditation, gradually, one becomes a little more detached, and you can start to see that you're actually, you've been living out there, whirling around on this wheel of your feelings and thoughts, and they're so convincing, aren't they? Incredibly convincing. Of course, that's right. Of course I'm right. Of course that's, he said, you said, all this stuff. And that was, again, very helpful. Don't be attached to these things. Just sit as a Buddha. There's something that can sit regardless of all this stuff. And you begin to step forward and act in a way that is, accepting the humanity of that, but not being enslaved to one's emotions and feelings and thoughts. It's quite remarkable. And seeing just the impermanence of them, just seeing over years of training how you can be completely convinced of something at one time, and later you realize that you don't feel that way at all. Why was I so strong about that? I don't agree with that anymore. Very interesting observation. So those were some little jewels from my first year as a monk here with Reverend Master Jiu. I was very inspired by her teaching. She was very energetic, of course, was a great, very good speaker. But also, she just lived it. She really embodied the teaching. She was human. She had her, hard times. But always there was this sense of great respect for others. And she really saw us as future ancestors, you know, future Buddhas, really, and respected our Buddha nature. So she could be very strict with us in certain ways, and at the same time incredibly kind. And that is a form of kindness, you know. As they say, deeds of the utmost kindness can sometimes be very uncomfortable and difficult at the time. But she was never unnecessarily, she was never mean and unnecessarily strict. One bit of teaching that I remember was also very helpful at that time was she would talk about the importance of the vow that we make when we recite the Kesa verse every morning. We put the Kesa on our heads, or our you know, as lay trainees, your Wagesa. And because often we were all, a lot of us young people then, you're a bit daunted about, you know, making a commitment to train forever and ever, and you quite don't really know what that means. It all seems so huge. And she would emphasize the importance of making the vow for the day, you know, putting your kesa on your head and doing that wholeheartedly and committing yourself to training for that day. In other words, somehow it just made it all possible for me. I can do this for today. Today I can do this. So not only did it make it doable and possible for me, it also refreshed it. You refreshed it every day. It wasn't something you just did when you took the precepts or when you were ordained and then you were, you know, on the safe track, as it were. You had to refresh it and keep it alive. And there was something about that. Even today, I find that really, really helpful. For today, I am refreshing this. It's coming alive again, and I commit myself to doing it today. You know, and there have been times in my training when I broke that down into hourly increments or minutes or seconds. I remember a time when it was one rosary bead at a time. It was that hard, you know. And whatever it is, it's moving, it's flowing, and to keep going with it. I remember a little personal incident. She was often, when her health was good enough, she'd be out working with us. I think Reverend Master Daishin was describing some of that. I remember doing something at the other end of the property, and she was out there guiding some of the work, and she called me over to help with something. I can't remember what it was. And I said, oh, just a minute, I have to tell, you know, I was going to finish off, so I had to tell somebody something. And just a minute. And because, again, pretty clueless at the time, a pretty new trainee. And I heard about that later, and she, you know, maybe it was immensely helpful teaching. She made it very clear to me that it wasn't appropriate. And the point being, it taught me, and this happened in different ways, you know, to look at my ability to be distracted and also to be a little scared of just being still with the call that comes from within. Because the master, it wasn't that she wanted me to be absolutely obedient to her as a person, but rather the teacher, the master is teaching one to kind of go within and respond to the inner call. And this was very significant to my training and still is, you know. So I remember how she said, you know, just come. And I often have thought, you know, when we come to the point of death, you know, are we going to say to the eternal, not just now, I have to first talk to this person or finish this up, or maybe, oh, so-and-so wants to, you know, can you wait a minute? Somehow that relates to it. It's very much along those lines. And it's something to think about, you know, how to be just right there and be ready and to switch. You know, a lot of our training, our early training was like that. Not that it wasn't like boot camp. We were ordered around. It wasn't like that at all. But just the schedule itself, you know, with the different activities, the bells going, the han going, you had to let go of things and go to the next thing. Or you'd be in the middle of, I remember cooking in the kitchen or baking with one of the monks who was here, no longer here, baking, and you'd get a call from Reverend Master Jia to come down. You were in the middle of something, you know, and you learned to just go. And, you know, it seemed impossible at the time. No, I can't leave this. But there was always some way, or you could pass it on to someone. But the important thing was to say yes first, before, because there's all this long list of objections and distractions that usually comes up. And they're all very reasonable, right? And so there was a teaching there. And I have to say, I'm not sure it was always absolutely deliberate. It's not like the master is always thinking, now I have to teach Ando about da-da, so I'm going to do da-da-da-da. It wasn't always necessarily that deliberate. Maybe sometimes, because especially after she got to know you, you know, which was a blessing. But often it was just the way things arose. And so I offer this because also with the understanding that really the master in this sense appears in your daily lives also. You know, circumstances will put you in this position and you can find the master teaching in that situation. You know, so we learned to just say, okay, I'll come. And we went down. And often, sometimes it was something seemingly very insignificant, you know. And there, you left this big, important job to do such and such, and you learned to just relax and find out what really mattered, what really was important, you know. So that was very, very valuable. In terms of her her trust or her teaching of us, we studied the Denkaroku, among many other things. You all know that teaching. And as I mentioned, she taught us to see each ancestor as a human being. They had their koan, their difficulties. And of course, the Kizan describes how each one also resolved their koans, how they trained themselves and awakened to the truth. And Reverend Master taught us the Denkaroku in order to help us to see our own training in that way. She made it clear to us that none of us was in any way, fundamentally different to any of the Buddhas and ancestors. And this was something in various ways that she communicated to us over and over. As I mentioned, she saw us as future ancestors and Buddhas. And that applied to lay trainees too. She could see people's capability and she would respond to that, to the Buddha nature. And sometimes that was uncomfortable, and in the end, it was always incredibly encouraging. So she didn't allow us to settle for less. Yeah. So there really, it was clear that, you know, there was no impediment. Being a woman, or being a man, or for that matter, being young or old, being ill. I mean, she was often not that well, and yet was remarkably energetic in spirit, even when she was very ill. We could, you know, if you can think of all sorts of, certainly in my, you know, throughout my training, all sorts of reasons why maybe I can't quite do it all, you know, quite, you know, can't quite go all the way, or, you know, I'll go this far. You don't deliberately do that, but the mind sets up these conditions, yeah. And so she, her teaching on this, she really helped us to become aware of those things, how we set up these limitations for ourselves, and that we don't have to. You know, through the meditation practice, through studying the Dharma, we can learn to, okay, see them, see what the mind is throwing up, but don't believe it all. Don't buy into it. Don't buy into what the world says, all these little categories you get put into, you know. There is really no impediment. And of course, this is something I'm very much still working on, and we're realizing for ourselves, each of us. But she made it very clear to us there was nothing to stand in the way of our going all the way in training. Whether we did it in this lifetime or in the next, it's not like we're in a race to finish it before we die. Could get hit by a bus, and who knows, might go all the way right then and there, or maybe it'll happen in another life. The point is not to buy into this idea that maybe not quite good enough or not quite whatever, we're Westerners, we're all these things that come to the mind. And she made that very, very clear that there were no obstacles ultimately. Now, this wasn't intended to create pride in us. If that arose, of course, then that would become an obstacle, and she'd highlight that. She'd point that out in some appropriate way also. The point is just to be willing to keep going no matter what. And again, this held me in very good stead during later times when a lot of karma was coming up for me to clean up, my marriage, and, you know, left. And and that was fine, but, you know, people I knew well who were good friends of mine here left, and it was very sad, and it brings up a lot of doubt and confusion. among many other things, just karma from this life and other lives, that are, you know, can be very convincing in terms of, you know, can I really go on, this sort of thing. It held me in good stead, and I began to, again, remember some of these things that she taught us, and realizing, oh yeah, this is just another one of those little pop-up things, you know, like in the movie sets, you know, there's this little facade in the, you know, the old Western movie sets, so they have, but there's nothing behind it. And you get to know these things, and get to know, oh, okay, I can walk through that door, fine, no problem. And this is a very, very great gift, and is a real jewel, her ability to inspire and encourage people in their training. I'm going to quote you a little piece from great master Keizan Stenko Roku on this, one of my favorite chapters, although I love them all. Great master Tozan Ryokai, I feel that Reverend Master Jiu really embodied this teaching. He was, of course, one of the founders of Soto Zen, the To in Soto. And this is his little poem after his master pushed him through a door a little bit, or he stepped through the door. Truly, I should not seek for the truth from others, for then it will be far from me. Now I am going alone. Everywhere I am able to meet him, or she, her, or it. He is me now. These are capitalized, the he's. I am not him, in capitals. When we understand this, we are instantaneously with the truth. Anyway, that was very inspiring to me when I had to step off into a new kind of aloneness, which is a very bright, wonderful place to be, but at first it looked kind of dark. And so that was very inspiring. In 1976, Reverend Master got quite ill and, you know, went to Berkeley, as many of you know, and eventually thought she was going to die and decided she was going to make the best death possible and ended up having a major religious experience, which she wrote about in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. So we have this great depth of teaching in that. And she came back to the Abbey, basically in a way having let go of everything and giving us the choice as to whether we wanted her back. And we said yes. And she came back and began to teach from her new experience. And that was one of the things that she taught about. Because I was a married person, this was, of course, significant to me. She talked about, you know, sublimating desire, sublimating sexual desire, for example, and what that meant, and using greed positively. And I found that was a big, important teaching. And just how to deal with desire. You know, people are often confused about that. You know, I have certain needs and things I have to have, but you know, what about this desire thing? And she talked about sublimating it. It wasn't a matter of squelching it or seeing it as bad or good. There's no good and bad in it. But rather, you know, as one goes on in training and into the deeper levels, one naturally is drawn to a nobler expression of life. Yeah. And so with all of our desires, whatever they might be for fame or money or food or things or sex or other people or recognition of various sorts, we could just sit still with that and allow it to be there and use that energy and allow it to develop into a longing for something greater, and yet not repressing it. Yeah. So it was a very liberal kind of teaching. I saw her as a person who had great liberality. I don't know quite how to explain that, but she, you know, she could have very conservative views in certain regards. And coming from Canada, you know, I thought I was very liberally minded, but I began to realize after a while how narrow much of my thinking was. When I first came here, you know, there was the whole Watergate scandal, and Reverend Master, you know, we were all angry about that, and Reverend Master would repeatedly say to us, Now, this is the Bodhisattva teaching us what not to do. She was really serious about that. So she wouldn't let us go over into, you know, ranting and raving about it and all the judgmentalism that came with it. Of course it was not good to do. But this is good to see. Yeah? But to see it from a non-judgmental perspective is a totally different thing. To see it from the Bodhisattva mind is to see it without any judgment at all. Yeah? And just to hold it within one's meditation. This is the Bodhisattva showing us what not to do. That sounds kind of far out, but later in life, I found myself in many, many situations where some very annoying things were happening, either in the world or in relationships or around me, and I found it very valuable to step back and say, what not to do, what not to do. And it just lifted the annoyance, the anger, whatever, the irritation. It just lifted it out of me, you know, sitting still with that. So that was a very big teaching. And it was just one of many examples of how she had this great liberality in terms of ethics, in terms of keeping precepts very deeply, in terms of tolerance for others, in terms of non-judgmentalism. Going to give you one more example of just incredibly clear teaching on Buddhist subjects that are often very, you know, can be very confused. In the introduction to the Dankaroka, which most of you may have read, Reverend Master Jiyu does a bit of explanation on some of the terminology that's used. And so I'll just read a little bit of this to give you a sense of how clear and how she cuts through some of the confusion that can exist with Buddhist teaching. She says, the term Buddha, in quotes, does not imply God, in quotes, any more than do the terms it, in quotes, or substance. And all the other terms we use, such as eternal and Lord of the House. It, in quotes, and all the other terms, again in this book in particular, should be understood as that which, within every fiber of our being, we know as that which is unborn, unchanging, undying, uncreated, frequently called it, in capitals. The doctrines of karma and anatta, no separate self, should be understood from the viewpoint of it. This, to me, is a very, very significant aspect of her teaching. So that I'll say that again. The doctrines of karma and anatta should be understood from the viewpoint of it, the undying, unborn, uncreated. In the case of the doctrine of karma, this means no doer is there who does the deed. This is a quote from the Buddha's teaching. Nor is there one who feels the fruit. In other words, if we just sit still with whatever is arising in the form of feeling or thought, however the karma is ripening, we see that there isn't an actual entity of a me in there. There's just the ripening of karma, which is being cleansed through meditation. So in the case of the doctrine of karma, this means no doer is there who does the deed, nor is there one who feels the fruit. And in the case of the doctrine of anatta, that there is no separate egocentric self outside of the true I, or true self, no separate self outside of the true self. So it's not that there's this negative void or nihilism, but rather it's no separate egocentric self outside of the true I, or the true self, which is the unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging. And somehow that passage is very significant to me, because there is this great, the great cosmic Buddha, as she sometimes referred to it, not a personal God, but there is this greatness that we're a part of. But it's in the context of that that we experience anatta, we get to know anatta, karma, etc. Unfortunately, there have been many muddles, especially in the West, as a result of an indiscriminate proliferation of terms used for the indefinable, unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging. Without their being directly connected up to what the terms Buddha, it, and the others above and throughout this book refer to. Some scholars have been so afraid to try and give any definition whatsoever that the whole fabric of what Buddhism is teaching becomes unraveled. One must understand that one must not be afraid of words, and one must not become a slave to them. All of the terms above are used to describe it, in capitals, and can help us to acquire the kaleidoscopic mind that can allow us to know it, in capitals, in every sense of the word know. In other words, not just from one perspective, but the great one. At all times, thus, with the above understanding of their meaning, the proliferation of terms for it in this book is very important. Because of a common misconception of the doctrine of anatta, the doctrine of no permanent separate self, the doctrines of karmic consequence and that of rebirth often have been muddled badly. However, if it is understood that at the very deepest level, there is no self that does the deed, nor one that feels the fruit, because there is no separate self when one is with the unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging, then the muddle is much easier to unravel, and we can put rebirth and karmic consequence in their proper perspective. And you know, feel free to continue to read this. It's in the introduction to the Zankoroku. And it's just such a, to me, you know, juicy, clear explanation that cuts through so much confusion and explains also why she did use so many different terms often to refer to that which is. And she was quite happy with people using different terms or using no terms, explaining it in other ways. She wasn't stuck with a particular way, but she often did use positive terms, as are sometimes described in the Christian tradition as the apophatic, because... Or is it the cataphatic, Reverend Helen? Apophatic, isn't it? In other words, you know, in terms of the positive, because... The cataphatic is positive. Okay, I'm get those mixed up. In other words, because there can be this... There's just a tremendous amount of depression somehow in the West. You know, people can get very much an idea that it's kind of a negative thing. And when in fact it's a very positive, bright thing that you awaken to. There's that which you awaken to, yeah? Through the letting go of everything, yeah. So I just offered that because it's so significant and runs through all of her teaching. Well, of course, I could tell many other stories, and I might just end with a few notes on, in terms of my relationship with Reverend Master Jiyu, an awareness of how much she actually trusted us, her disciples, her lay trainees, her congregation. The way she related to us was one of trust, as I have already alluded to, and in practical terms that applied to me, in that she gave me positions of a lot of responsibility when I was quite a new monk, partly out of necessity, because we were all newer monks then, but also because she saw something in me that I couldn't yet see, but I was able to act on, interestingly enough. And so she would offer you something, and you'd, if you said yes, you found usually a way of doing it. There were times, as I mentioned before, when I didn't realize that, and I turned her down, unfortunately. But it was very clear to her. There was no question at all in the mind as to whether a woman could do this or not. I mean, it wasn't a question, you know. It really wasn't, and it still isn't. So it was a great gift that she gave us all, both men and women, in that regard. Some people think she was a bit harder on women than men in her teaching of her disciples. I myself didn't have that experience. You know, I've tried to think about that, and I really didn't have that experience. It may have happened with others, but I think that she she knew what we were capable of. And so she didn't let us settle for second best, you know? Unfortunately, that has happened in even some other traditions of Buddhism and in other religions to some extent. It's very subtle. It's very subtle what that can do to the mind. So she made it very clear that this wasn't an impediment in the slightest, and there wasn't even a question there. She taught us to be content and not create opposites where they didn't exist. And that was a teaching, too, that now and then, when I was in a difficult place, would come through. Be content. Do not create opposites where they do not exist. Oy. I mean, it was just like this, you know, again, this hook pulling you out of this sea of suffering. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. The teaching in that sense is helping us to awaken to the truth. This is the awakening to the truth, which we do through our zazen and through heeding the Dharma and taking refuge in the Sangha. Urban Master taught us to be as monks, in this case, my case, that we were monks first, or trainees, and then we were people who were gardening or cooks, you know. In other words, because there was this great tendency to get caught up in our activity and identifying so much with our activity or our position or our whatever, things, external things, it was very important, and she mentioned this over and over when I was a younger monk, remember that you're a monk who is cooking or is doing secretarial work or is greeting guests or... Yeah, so you're, and that was so important. And again, and you can insert in there trainee. You know, if you learn to do that in your training, everything becomes easier to bear. Everything really, because you've always got something to do. There's always something you can do. There's always a place where you can be whole and complete, and at ease. And, you know, it's not easy. I mean, we're all struggling with that, and I still work on that all the time. But it's a very wonderful gift that she gave us. So, yes, you know, you can be wholehearted about your work, but remember to always come back to that, you know, to the important thing. A few experiences that I had of her great kindness... I didn't see much of that as I wish I had when I was a younger monk. When I was away from the abbey for a number of years, and I was in touch with her and would come back now and then, but paying off my debts and kind of sorting out, you know, in my mind what was good to do and not good to do and so on. I remember there was a time when it was a very difficult period. Jobs were getting difficult, a lot more temporary jobs around, and I lost my job, and then I lost the place I was living pretty in a short period of time, partly out of my own foolishness and not paying enough attention. And rather than going to my family, I decided to go to a nearby women's shelter and stayed there for a while. And it was a little rough, but I managed to get another job and eventually a place to live within a short time. But during that time, I was at a pretty low point, and I was the place was not far from Chinatown in Vancouver. And I would walk through Chinatown once in a while. And I would see these statues of Kanzeon in the window, you know. And there were a lot of these Kanzeon, different kinds of Kanzeons. And I have to say, that was Reverend Master. I saw Reverend Master in all those statues. And it was amazingly helpful. And because I thought of myself, I felt really badly about myself at that time. And just seeing her again... And everywhere, you know, through the statues, things would pop up and I would see her she was the Kanzeon. And reflecting on that in later years, I realized the great value and depth of the transmission and the teaching relationship. And really, any trainee will have that with the Dharma as they practice more deeply. You will be helped. The Buddhas will come to help you and reach out to you. So it was amazingly kind and helpful. And many a time I would finish work, later on I got another job, and then eventually got my own tutoring service, which went a bit better. But I would come home each day, and rather than turning on the TV, I would go to my altar and offer incense. And I often had a sense of Reverend Master being there and bowing to her, you know. And it was so encouraging because I was really stepping out on my own in a new way. And I wasn't just being, just living alone, but it was a new depth of training as well. Reverend Master was incredibly kind with not only people, but also animals. She taught me to see animals as real people. I'd never had that experience before. I'd had pets, and my favorite pet that I had when I was a kid was a rabbit, bunny rabbit, and within a week or so it was gone, and I heard it was in the soup, and I thought that was very disappointing. So I just sort of learned to not look for pets, you know. I mean, you know, that's what people do, they, you know. So I was weary about getting close to animals, leery of that, and Reverend Master taught me how to relate to animals and a gentleness and kindness and see them as real people in a way that, you know, real beings. Had a drop of, we had this big Dalmatian, whom you may have heard of, who was pretty feisty. I was asked to take him for walks for a certain period, and he would kind of take me for a walk, you know. He's very large, muscular, and he had his own mind. And there are lots of stories about Sam, the Dalmatian. And So I'd be, you know, yanking this dog around, trying to control it. Reverend Master, I remember on one occasion, walked past me and said, let him do what he needs to do. You know, so I had to, it was a very good teaching for me. And this is the way Reverend Master taught. A lot of the teaching that we receive from her, and really the way the Dharma works, is in ordinary daily life situations. Again, she may not have been deliberately teaching me something, but yes, on one level she was. And it taught me how to restrain and control whilst allowing at the same time, you know, also within myself, things within myself, if you understand, those you know, unruly aspects of myself through walking the dog. It was interesting how to train the dog, how to train myself. And so our relationship with animals, through that, she had a lot of dogs and cats, and she liked to rescue animals from the pounds, you know. So most of her pets came from pounds, dogs, you know, dogs especially that were about to get gassed. And she would teach us about all sorts of things by observing the animals. She had great sympathy and concern for people. Many a time somebody's relative would die. I remember one of my nieces attempted suicide once. I would talk with her about it. There would be a sense as if she were, she didn't know the person, it wasn't her family, but I always had this sense of, like as if it were a close relative of hers. You know, there was that sense of she really understood. I think that's enough for now, and of course there are many, many other jewels in this garland. I could repeat many things that have already been said, because her great faith and her great certainty, of course, were an incredible inspiration. It was a certainty of faith, really. It wasn't a certainty of, I'm right about everything. And that's a very important distinction, and I think another big teaching for us these days, where one can get confused about what certainty is. So it's a certainty of faith, a certainty in the unborn and the uncreated. But within that, anything is possible. And sometimes one is right and sometimes one is wrong. And sometimes it just doesn't matter. You know? So I'm going to just end with a little bit of a quote from my absolute favorite article here, which is in, interestingly enough, our introductory booklet. So we have it right there. People are new. They get our introduction to the tradition of Serene Reflection Meditation, and it's Reverend Master Jiyu's article on perfect faith. It's a transcription of a talk that she gave during a retreat here, and I won't read the whole thing because most of you have probably read it, but it perhaps clarifies a bit more of what I mean by certainty, the teaching relationship, and faith. She says, Perfect faith, however, does not require this. What it does require is that you accept everything with a positive attitude of mind. Absolute faith, which is a requirement of many religions, differs from perfect faith in that absolute implies a hardness with no means whatsoever of allowing in softness or change. It's absolute. There can be no differences or movement within it. Absolute faith is rigid and results in bigotry, fear, and frequently in the giving up of the will. In perfect faith, there is a give and take on the side of both master and disciple, a willingness of the master to ask the help of the disciple, and a willingness of the disciple to ask the help of the master, but all with a positive attitude of mind. If it becomes hard or heavy, it is not perfect faith. Perfect faith is full of lightness and love. It's softer than a cloud, yet harder than a diamond. It's all of these things and changes constantly. I won't go into the rest of it because you can read this yourself. But she makes the point that there's absolute free will in our particular tradition. Please be very careful of this point, she says. Perfect faith is always changing and always the same. Always interesting and always joyful, never seeing an opposite because it has indeed gone beyond opposites. Opposites can only exist when we have not yet transcended them. When they have been transcended, every day is a good day, as Keizan says, and all work is the work of a Buddha. Then there is no such thing as good and bad, like and dislike. There is only the positivity that lies beyond these opposites. And remember also, it's a positivity that does not require positivity, a truth that does not insist upon truth. It's a love that does not insist upon being loved, but loves for the sake of loving. This is why we should be very careful of not judging ourselves. Since the Lord of the house does not judge us, why are we so stupid as to live within the opposites and judge ourselves? We need to have a faith that does not insist upon faith. This is what the master must teach. And so on. I'll let you read the rest of it. And I'll offer that little bit of Dharma from Reverend Master Jiyu. Thank you for coming. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.